Hello, I'm Kevin Holden, and this is number 0375 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0375. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Robert S. Bader, who is the author of four of the Three Musketeers, The Marx Brothers on Stage. What got him interested in their early career?
When I first started seeing their movies, and this is as a kid many years ago, it was not lost on me that they weren't particularly young when they started. You know, doing a little bit of checking, I realized they were in their late 30s and early 40s when they made their first movie. I said, you don't just start making movies at that point. And I read a little bit and saw that they had worked in vaudeville and they were on Broadway, and I was really interested in the 25 years of their career before the movies.
IT expert Nick Paris, president and founder of Alpha Computing Solutions, talks about safeguards against hacking. Is there more hacking these days, or more media coverage about hacking?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I do believe that there's more hacking going on now than at any other time in history, partially because we are so connected. Think about even 5 years ago, we weren't as interconnected as we are today. Everything is kind of connected together. And so because of that, it sort of lends itself to this notion of being able to hack into everything. But also, because we are so connected, we also hear about things at an incredible speed. So when something happens, it's almost instantaneous that we hear about it in some form or another.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, James Patterson is going to give us a shot. Book shot, that is. More details coming soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news. We'll check the mailbag. And, of course, there is an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you that this was show number 0375, was Kevin Holden, a former broadcaster and colleague of mine at that old radio station I worked at, now a high school teacher, so he's working with a tougher crowd. Thank you very much, Kevin, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? According to doctors, a Honduran man was rushed to hospital after his private parts were stuck inside a soda bottle for several days. The 50-year-old man, who was not identified, and honestly, would you want to be, told doctors that he occasionally used the soda bottle to pleasure himself as he was unable to get it on with a woman. However, last week, after the 50-year-old man forced his private parts into the soda bottle, he was unable to remove it. He was very embarrassed and refrained from seeking help. After 4 days, his private parts turned black and began to decay as a result of necrosis. He checked himself into a hospital where doctors had no choice but to remove his private parts. The man can no longer have sex, but he is still able to urinate. Well, not to be harsh, but it's not like he was getting any before anyway, was he? This has got to be the most literal example of use it or lose it. And now that I think about it, it was a soda bottle. He had it on there for 4 days. Did he ever think to just break the bottle? Anyway. There are people who will do silly things to themselves, like that last guy, and then there are those who will do silly things in the name of a dare or a contest. Case in point. A team of San Francisco area doctors detailed the case of a 47-year-old man whose attempt to eat ghost peppers caused a rupture in his esophagus. The Journal of Emergency Medicine case report, authored by Dr. Craig Smolin, and his team said the man was participating in an eating contest at a San Francisco restaurant when he wolfed down a hamburger topped with ghost peppers, which have more than twice the heat of habanero peppers. The man suffered severe vomiting and dry heaving after ingesting the peppers, leading him to be admitted to the University of California San Francisco Medical Center. Doctors discovered the man had suffered a 1-inch rupture in his esophagus, which allowed food debris and air to end up in his chest and collapse one of his lungs. There are many people who have ghost peppers, and most people don't develop any type of severe symptoms, Smolin said to the Los Angeles Times, which, by the way, if you check medical records, apparently no one has had this problem before, so it's not the fact that most people don't develop it. Nobody does. Anyway, this case serves as an important reminder of a potentially life-threatening surgical emergency initially interpreted as discomfort after a large spicy meal, the study author wrote. You know, but the study fails to acknowledge how stupid people can be. Yeah, that's an important point, a very important point. Okay, here's a quote from 24-year-old Ryan Matthew Stanislaw. I'm out here making sure my neighborhood is safe. Yeah, we've heard lines like that before. That's what he told police in North St. Paul, Minnesota. I didn't see the cops, so I figured I'd do something. It was roughly 5 a.m., and Stanislaw, AR-15 rifle around his neck, had allegedly tried to shoot a zombie. He even had ammunition specifically designed for zombie elimination. One of his bullets had broken a window and struck the head of a bed where a man was sleeping. Police thought Stanislaw smelled of alcohol and arrested him. Well, mission accomplished. The zombie is off the streets. The anchor of Hope Baptist Church in Canyon, Texas, placed an ad in the local newspaper calling craft beer the devil's craft, citing Bible verses warning against the evils of drinking and insisting Jesus never drank booze. Canyon's Imperial Tap Room called the ad a coupon. We'll give you $1 off for each one you bring in, so feel free to bring multiple, they said on Facebook. Come enjoy some devilishly tasty craft beer. Some comments praised the tap room's marketing technique, calling it brilliant and genius. Others commented on the church's ad, including one who thought, these folks seriously need a drink. Yeah. Well, to quote a certain book, let beer be for those who are perishing, wine for those who are in anguish. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Proverbs 31, verses 6 and 7. Just saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, another religious story to share with you. The Reverend Bob Marshall of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Buckley, Wales, likes to catch attention with a sign outside his church. A recent message caught plenty of attention. It's obvious to me what it meant, he said later, but it never really entered my mind it had another meaning. The sign read, forgiveness is swallowing when you just want to spit. A dubious sexual double entendre for a pastor to advertise. Now, Marshall, who grew up in Indiana before moving to Wales 30 years ago, said he had no idea what it meant over here. Yeah, like that double entendre only works in Wales. The pastor says he'll be soliciting input on future signs. Well, hey, Rev, here's another religious quote you should probably avoid. The most powerful position is on your knees. Yeah, that one wouldn't go over well either. Trust me. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Before film made them international comedy legends, the Marx Brothers developed their comedic skills on stage over a period of a quarter of a century. Robert S. Bader chronicles that era in his book, Four of the Three Musketeers, the Marx Brothers on Stage. And Robert joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this. You know, so many people are familiar with the Marx Brothers through their films and Groucho later on with his television show. But I would assume that there's a whole history of the Marx Brothers when they were on stage that people are totally unaware of. What made you decide that this was what you wanted to focus on?
Well, when I first started seeing their movies, and this is as a kid many years ago, it was not lost on me that they weren't particularly young when they started. You know, doing a little bit of checking, I realized they were in their late 30s and early 40s when they made their first movie. I said, you don't just start making movies at that point. And I read a little bit and saw that they had worked in vaudeville and they were on Broadway, and I was really interested in the 25 years of their career before the movies, and there just wasn't a lot of information out there about it. So I was a pretty inquisitive child, and I started going to the library and trying to read about it and learn about it. And I just started amassing all of this information, and the joke of it in my family was, what are you doing with all this stuff you're accumulating? And before I really thought I was ever going to write a book, I would just tell them, well, I'm going to write a book. And that sort of made people think I was less crazy. But basically, I did write a book, and it's really focused on that lost period where you just can't find a lot of information about them.
Well, as you say, there isn't a lot of information out there. So how did you go about digging into finding it? I mean, was it something that was chronicled in some far corners of the library that people had forgotten about? Or did you actually go to people who they worked with and dealt with? Or what was the process for you?
Well, interestingly, I did get to meet and speak to a lot of people who were close to them because I started doing this research, you know, as much as 30 years ago. So I got to know Harpo's wife and Chico's daughter very well, and I know Harpo's son, Bill, and spoke a lot with Groucho's daughter, Miriam, and son, Arthur. And they led me to some people who could tell me things, but mostly the research involved going to libraries and out-of-the-way places, and a lot of this began before you could even search any newspapers on the Internet, which you can do now, but it's still not comprehensive. And a lot of what the Marx Brothers did in their early days occurred in small towns. In fact, I even did some research on cities that don't exist anymore. The Marx Brothers played in some places, for example, in Pennsylvania. The cities have gone out of business, and you have to go to the State Historical Society to find anything. But I did a bit of that stuff, and, you know, using resources like the Internet and basically going to performing arts libraries like the one in New York at Lincoln Center, where I could go look through the vaudeville trade papers week by week. It was an arduous process, but I just kept finding the stuff that I was looking for. It's out there. You just can't find it easily. So it involved quite a bit of travel, actually.
Now, with the idea of putting this book together, who do you feel your exact audience was? Because, like you say, this is information that a lot of people aren't aware of, and were you concerned that maybe part of the problem was it wasn't information people were looking for in the first place?
Well, I had two goals here. One of them was to make sure it didn't only serve people who are fanatical about the Marx Brothers, which I am. I have several friends who are. I know a small group of people who would eat up anything I could find. If the book were 1,000 pages, they would buy it. Wasn't really after those people, but there was also something that's really important to understand if you want to look at the Marx Brothers' early years. You have to understand the vaudeville and the theater businesses, and that market isn't served at all. And I think theater historians will be very interested in learning how the vaudeville business worked and the economics of it and how difficult it was to make a living as a performer. But on the other hand, there was also a tremendous amount of opportunity if you were a performer. There was a point in this country's history where it was the primary form of entertainment and there were 40,000 working vaudevillians. That would probably be at the peak of it, maybe around 1915, 1920. But it was a major occupation, and it was a pretty middle-class occupation for most people, but it's an important part of the American economy for the first 25 years of the 20th century, and it's pretty much under-recorded, and you don't see it in the history books of theater much, but it was a very, very lucrative business. It was an illegal monopoly for many years, and it was one of the most lucrative businesses in American history. So I think that aspect of it should interest people in general history and theater history.
As someone who is a historian of the Marx Brothers and you've collected all this information over the years, when you finally decided to say, yes, I'm going to write this book, and you really delved into it, was there anything you learned with all your knowledge of these guys? Was there anything you learned that was a surprise to you?
Yeah, there were a lot of things, and it was always these sort of eureka moments where I'd be in some library in the middle of nowhere. In particular, a lot of this happened to me in Iowa. I just learned so much going to the State Historical Society of Iowa. And there was also a collection at the University of Iowa. The Keith Albee Vaudeville Circuit's papers are there, including manager's reports that were sent by the theater managers for internal use to the head of the chain. And you could see that in 1908, for example, the Marx Brothers got a pretty scathing review when they were in a singing act called The Four Nightingales. And it wasn't always easy for them. So one of the things I learned was some of their stories that they try to turn into sort of fun, like we were so lousy, that kind of thing. In the beginning, they really were reviewed as being lousy several times. And then they turned it into a joke and a story, and then they really did improve as an act. But there wasn't a great humorous story for them to tell by being good and being successful. So they stuck with the "we were lousy" story for decades. In their memoirs, Harpo and Groucho both talk about how bad they were. But I think that situation only existed to them for a short couple of years, and then they became very, very good and made a lot of money and were very well reviewed. But they loved telling the story of how they were so lousy in the beginning. So that was kind of fun to learn, because you would think that they didn't survive in vaudeville for 20 years being terrible.
You talk about the business model that vaudeville was at that time. Any lessons learned there that could be applicable to entertainment business models today, or is it really just a completely different world?
No, actually, there's some things that correlate, and they're very unusual, because one of the things that fascinated me, and I did a lot of research on this, mostly because I wanted to know it for myself, and I did use some of it in the book, I studied how they were able to get away with being a complete monopoly and stopping other people from getting into the vaudeville business. And there were basically three or four vaudeville moguls who managed to keep an iron grip on this business and just make all the money. And, you know, underpay performers, control salaries, keep people from being in competition with them. And, you know, you look at some of the businesses out there in the entertainment business today, and not to pick on any one in particular, but I'll mention something like Ticketmaster and Live Nation. If you have a concert hall and you want to sell tickets, you can't do it yourself. You know, you've pretty much got to go into business with them. It's a little different because it's a very different business world, but you could compare something like Ticketmaster and Live Nation to the Keith and Orpheum circuits of 100 years ago. It's pretty much the only game in town if you want to get serious about that business. There may be small things that can exist outside of it, but they're not very impactful if you're in the business.
Later in life, as you mentioned, the Marx Brothers became big in film. There were a lot of performers in the vaudeville era. During that vaudeville era, how big were the Marx Brothers in it?
Well, that's interesting, because up until about 1914, the fall of 1914 was a big breakthrough for them. They had been blacklisted from playing on the big vaudeville circuits because they had played for some of the competitors of the big monopoly, and they were kept out of the big time. And they started making so much money as independents doing the small time stuff that they were brought in because the big guys were tired of them taking away income. So they grew and grew, and they became very, very successful in vaudeville. So they did go from the very bottom to the very top. And at one point, they were the highest paid act in vaudeville. They were making about $10,000 a week when a really big performer might get, you know, $7,000. So they were doing really, really well in it. And of course, the Marx Brothers had a problem playing by the rules. They got into trouble again. And the second time they got blacklisted, they were literally kicked out of vaudeville, which is what led them to Broadway. But they had this penchant for getting into trouble, which you wouldn't be surprised because they're the Marx Brothers, but they definitely were their own worst enemy on numerous occasions in their early career. And that's one of the things that I was really glad to be able to point out and figure out, see how that affected them.
Talent will always be talent. Do you think somebody like the Marx Brothers or a group like the Marx Brothers could have been popular today if they were around today?
I think they could be, but I think it's interesting because Groucho and a lot of other old vaudevillians, people like George Burns and Jack Benny, and there are very few that had long careers like those guys, they used to say things like, you know, you can't develop an act like we did because there's no place to be lousy anymore. You could be on a vaudeville circuit for a couple of years working your act, and it doesn't get any kind of national exposure, but you go on TV and do 8 minutes on a television show, your act is out there, and now you have to make a new one. So I think some of these acts in vaudeville did the same act for years. The Marx Brothers played the same show for 7 seasons at one point, and they would come around the country, and people would want them to be back in their city and see it again. Didn't care if it was the same act. But now something like television will just blow up your act in one shot. So I always think back to when Groucho and some of those other fellows would say things like, there's just no place to be lousy anymore.
The first part of the title of your book, Four of the Three Musketeers, what does that mean?
Well, it's a song that became sort of a signature number for them in the Broadway version of Animal Crackers. And when they had to make Animal Crackers into a movie, the stage show ran roughly 2 hours and 45 minutes because it had a lot of music in it. And in those days when they were turning Broadway musicals into movies, the first thing they did to shorten it was cut out a bunch of songs. And Four of the Three Musketeers was cut. So they did it in their stage acts after Animal Crackers. It was a popular song, and it was sort of their theme song for a few years. And when they returned to the vaudeville stages after being big stars on Broadway in the movies, they would sometimes be advertised as the Musketeers of Mirth because that song was so well known. And now it's pretty unknown. So I've reprinted the lyrics in the book, and it's really a big part of their act. And at that point, you know, from 1928 till they stopped performing on stage as the Four March Brothers in early 1932, that was a signature piece of the act.
For anybody who's a fan of either the Marx Brothers or vaudeville or both, this is a must-have. It's four of the Three Musketeers, the Marx Brothers, on stage, written by Robert S. Bader. People can find out more information by going to your website, marxbrothers.net. Robert, I thank you very, very much for taking time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Robert S. Bader, author of Four of the Three Musketeers, the Marx Brothers on Stage. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0375, and you'll find links to Robert's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about computer hacking. Plus, Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter, and we have lots more Stuff File news coming your way, and the mailbag section here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, the retail chain Target has ended its expanded pilot program, which tested giving miniature shopping carts to young children who accompanied parents while shopping. Target's primary demographic, by the way. The trial was apparently successful at first. 10 stores had them for a year, and many parents seemed to have really liked them. But after only a few weeks, after expanding the program to 50 stores in Minnesota and 22 in New York, overwhelming complaints forced early cancellation. Children got carried away with the carts, racing down aisles, putting merchandise in the carts that parents had no interest in buying, and driving the carts into other shoppers. So, where are the carts now? In storage, while Target figures out what to do with them. Well, duh. Sell them to the parents who can have them for their kids. Just keep them out of the store. I'm sure the kids will enjoy them. Let them zoom around the house and cause havoc there. Anyway, by the way, this is something that has been in my area supermarkets for years now, and I can see how some would complain. You know, nothing will make you drop to your knees faster than the fruit of someone's loins running full speed with one of these miniature missiles into the back of your Achilles tendon. Trust me. I know from experience. Trust me. Anyway, Kevin and Tammy Jones opened their Guns and Coffee store in an old bank building in Hamilton, Virginia, in August. But despite the controversies about the ease of gun acquisition in America, their bullets and beans shop has had a harder time pleasing government regulators over the coffee than over the firearms. Kevin told Washingtonian Magazine that there were no problems in getting gun shop and firearm instruction permits from state and federal agencies, but several local government roadblocks delayed the coffee sales permit and the property being zoned for retail but not food or drinks, and for permission to open certain businesses near residences and a coffee shop's need to have parking. Yeah, well, too bad there isn't an amendment guaranteeing the right to brew coffee, huh? And let's chalk this one up as a major victory in the war against drugs. On September 21st, as part of a six-target raid using military-type helicopters by the Massachusetts State Police and the National Guard, drug warriors halted the criminal enterprise of 81-year-old Margaret Holcomb of Amherst, seizing the one and only marijuana plant in her yard that she had planted to harvest soon for relief of her arthritis and glaucoma. Well, thanks to all that firepower, the world is a much safer place. Or at least Amherst is. You know, some people have a compulsion to steal. And to prove that point, we have a couple of stories here that are perfect examples. Number one, 31-year-old Joshua Hunt was arrested in October inside St. Francis Hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he had gone to check on his 9-month-old son who was being treated for an injury. Police said that while in the ward, he snatched another visitor's purse and took a cell phone and credit cards. And number two, 25-year-old Brittany Carulli was arrested in Harrison Township, New Jersey in October, charged with stealing a medic's wallet from inside an ambulance. The medic had allowed Brittany into the ambulance to grieve over her boyfriend's body after he was struck and killed by a car. Wow. I'm guessing she wasn't really that grief-stricken. Or maybe she just wasn't really that into him. Or both. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, how bad has the current clampdown on clowns gotten? A British swingers club is kiboshing clowns attending its annual Halloween orgy. Paradise Spa in London is advertising the group sex extravaganza, instructing lusty couples to wear their sexy costumes, but there is one exception. No jaunty jesters. Clown costumes are forbidden. Their ad goes as follows. Join the staff and regulars for this year's Halloween party. Fancy dress with a prize for the best. And then the rest of it is in all caps. Please note, clown costumes are not permitted and will be turned away. The Sin Bin claims it has a fully stocked bar, a big screen that shows porn nonstop, hot tubs, and sex rooms, and it offers free pizza on weekends. Yeah, I'm sure the pizza is quite the draw. Meanwhile, porn site X-Hamster, and that's a name that I can now not get out of my head, says that people prowling for X-rated clown action is on the rise. The website reports that searches for clown porn has climbed by a whopping 50%, There are orgies featuring clowns, BDSM with clowns, and every other kind of hardcore you can think of, all starring clowns. And the Daily Star is reporting that prostitutes have seen a spike in johns requesting kinky clown-related services, but the escorts themselves are wary. I've had guys asking for girls to dress as clowns and guys asking if they could be dressed as clowns during meetings, a madam told the tabloid. You know, it would appear that clowns are getting more press in the last little while than ISIS. And some people seem to feel the same way about both. Frightening times, indeed. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. By the year 2020, billions of devices will be connected to the internet. With all this technology comes the idea of consumers exposing themselves to an increased risk of falling victim to criminal activity such as being hacked. To talk about this issue, we're joined by information technology expert Nick Paris, president and founder of Alpha Computing Solutions. He joins us on the line right now from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Nick.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Thanks for being on the program with us. We constantly hear about the idea of hacking, the problems that comes with it. And nowadays, everyone has devices, and with each device, you have many sites you go to, many passwords you need to keep. How do we just keep up with all of this?
Well, it will settle down. At some point, all this technology will start to merge together, and we'll get to a point where it won't be so difficult to keep track of all this stuff. It'll just sort of work together. But unfortunately, at this point in time, we still have some hurdles to kind of get over. But it will settle down.
We're hearing, again, hacking in the news a lot. It's even in the political campaign that's taking place right now. And I'm just wondering, because we're hearing so much about hacking, is there that much hacking going on, or is it just that we're hearing about it so much?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I do believe that there's more hacking going on now than at any other time in history, partially because we are so connected. You think about even 5 years ago, we weren't as interconnected as we are today. Today, it's everything is kind of connected together. And so because of that, it sort of lends itself to this notion of being able to hack into everything. But also, because we are so connected, we also hear about things at an incredible speed. So when something happens, it's almost instantaneous that we hear about it in some form or another.
Well, let's look at it from a business point of view. First of all, are hacking attacks becoming more sophisticated? And is it something that is either predominantly domestic or foreign?
Well, actually, yes, from a business perspective, it's very prevalent. It's one of these things where, the hackers have become more organized and they're well-funded. Now it's a criminal enterprise. It's no longer just, some kid in his basement trying to hack into something. I mean, it's actually organized crime trying to get into your information as far as a business is concerned. So it's one of these things that, as the IT industry, we put a lot of effort and time into making sure that our clients are protected, but it isn't just a simple matter anymore.
Well, from an IT point of view, from a business point of view, what do you find hackers are going after more? Is it going after information that can be helpful to a competitor or can damage your business, or are they going after your business accounts to literally steal your money and funds? What's more prevalent?
No, I think it's more the latter. They're going more after straight direct funds. I'm sure there's some corporate espionage being done, but it's more just direct direct money. And that kind of lends back to your question from before about is it domestic or abroad. And I believe that most of what you're finding is it is coming from abroad. That's not to say that it's not happening domestically, but I think more than likely what they're looking to do is try to hack into your bank account and get your information or get your money from there.
There are a lot more small entrepreneurs these days, what with the world of social media and people actually making money online. So you have that entrepreneurial spirit, and therefore you have people who are not necessarily in the world of big business and know how to handle themselves when it comes to this. With more mom-and-pop businesses out there and financial transactions taking place online, are smaller businesses more vulnerable to the hacking than bigger companies?
They're more vulnerable, yes, but that's not to say that there isn't a vulnerability for the big guys as well. But certainly, one of the things that we try to, impress upon a prospect or a person that we're talking to is that you really need to engage the services of some IT professional to make sure that you are covered, at least from the perspective of, that your business is not wide open and have a stance of being able to be compromised. And, just like you would go and talk to an attorney if you had some legal matter, or even a doctor if you had some personal matter, you probably need to look to your IT professional to make sure that, they've looked over your systems and that your systems are secure. And if they're not, they'll tell you what you need to do.
Well, here's a two-pronged question. If I'm a small business or large business entrepreneur, and I'm concerned about hacking, what are some of the things I have to do to protect myself against the threats? And from a consumer point of view, because a lot of the stuff being hacked is to get the information of the consumer as well, what do I as a consumer have to concern myself with when shopping or dealing with business that has an online presence?
Okay, so for the business, the most basic thing is you want to have some type of hardware firewall in place, and that's a piece of equipment that basically monitors all the traffic coming in and out of your office. And those are really your first line of defense and your best line of defense to make sure that there isn't some type of virus or Trojan trying to get into your business to take things over. And so that's really kind of the first line. The second line is obviously having antivirus software on each of your computers and devices, as well as what's called anti-malware software on those devices as well. From a consumer perspective, the hardware firewalls are probably a little bit out of their price range, but certainly, if you could afford one, I would say, again, get one. But certainly, having firewalls and things like that in place or antivirus software certainly is a necessity. But I think too that when you're a consumer, you need to take responsibility. You need to think about what you're getting ready to do. I mean, if you're going to shop, shop at a kind of a trusted place. Don't go somewhere that you've never even heard of the company or anything like that. Or if you do absolutely have to do that, do a little bit of research on them. There's plenty of review sites online that you could, go to Google and search for their company name and then just type the word review afterwards, and you'll find places that have reviewed them. And then read the reviews. You need to kind of, be cautious about, okay, well, if 70-80% of the reviews are bad, well, then there's more than likely something going on at that company that you want to steer away from. If you've got the one or two out of a few hundred that are bad, well, that's just going to happen. That's just the way business is. You're going to get one or two people. You can't satisfy everybody. But you need to kind of look at the reviews, and I always say trust your gut. If your gut says something just seems off, then I would say try to find whatever product or service you need from somewhere else.
As someone who's in the IT world, your company being Alpha Computing Solutions, is it a never-ending foot race with the bad guys to a non-existent finish line? I mean, you come up with ways of trying to combat the hackers, and they come up with ways of trying to get around your last fix for their hack. Is it a never-ending battle?
It is right now. And like I was saying, I think at some point it will all settle down. But right now we are in a very reactive sort of state. I see some trends and some changes that are moving us away from that and being more proactive. But right now we're more reactive than proactive. But I do believe that at some point, Apple and Microsoft are going to have to address this to where the systems that we use are, clean and don't have any issues on them and can be proactive as far as keeping anybody out of our computer system.
As far as the hacking world is concerned, is part of the problem the fact that even though we are all so connected, it's still a relatively new situation for many of us, and therefore we're not taking the precautions that we should? In other words, the reason why hackers are hacking is because right now it's low-hanging fruit.
It is low-hanging fruit, but also I believe that it's difficult for law enforcement to do anything. You don't hear about that many wins of, hey, we found this hacker, or hey, we did this, or hey, we did that. And the other problem is when it is, across country lines, when it's abroad, that's even worse, because now you've got to try to convince some other government that, hey, we believe somebody in your jurisdiction has taken, active steps towards hacking into somebody in our country, and we want to prosecute. And I think that becomes more and more difficult. I think it's one of these things that it is a global problem, and so we have to come up with some type of global solution for being able to hunt these criminals down and take care of them as far as, hacking is concerned, because it is a big business. It has definitely turned into a very big business for criminals.
You mentioned jurisdiction and law. Another point is, Is the legal system keeping pace? Are there laws on the books that make this crime punishable enough that will also be a deterrent to hackers who are caught?
I don't believe so. I think we're still kind of catching up there as well. But I think maybe what might be driving some of that slowness is, well, if you could demonstrate that you could easily catch a hacker, then we might, come up with laws that would say, okay, well, then this is what the issue is. These are the penalties. But I think, you know, it is a process to try to track down, you know, where did the hack come from and where did it originate, and that's a little bit tougher. And so I think once we can get better about that, the laws will come. But I truly see down the road there just has to be a plan for, okay, we're going to design our operating system such that it can withstand hacks and not have these issues.
It is indeed a brave new world out there, and sometimes for some people a scary one. But if you do due diligence, one can stay ahead. It's most interesting to talk to you about this, Nick. I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much.
IT expert Nick Paris, president and founder of Alpha Computing Solutions. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0375, and you'll find links to Nick's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Incoming subspace signal.
Oh, time to check the mailbag. And we had an email pour into us. This one came from Bob Steele. Thank you very much, Bob, and it's a really nice email. Just finished listening to show number 0374. That's the one before this one. Of the Stuff File program. A friend of mine from London, England, asked me on Facebook if I had heard it. So your show is being listened to around the globe. And he, Bob, likes to keep score of the shows he enjoyed. He said, awesome, 374. Not awesome, zero. So right now I'm batting 1,000, according to Bob. Thank you very much. Bob also goes on to say, keep it up. I don't know if I told you this or not, but last year, while in Puerto Morelos in Mexico, that's about 20 minutes from Cancun, I was waiting in the hotel lobby for a taxi to Cancun. I had my iPod set on the Stuff File show. I was still sorting out my unconnected headset, so my iPod was playing in the lobby, not loud, but hearable if you passed by me closely. And a couple asked me where I was from. They recognized the podcast. Imagine my surprise. There I was in Backwater, Mexico. And by the way, Bob used a very colorful term between Backwater and Mexico. So there I was in Backwater, Mexico, almost in the middle of the jungle, and someone identified the Stuff File podcast. Take a bow. Well, thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate that. I would take a bow, but I do this show standing up, and if I bowed, my head would hit the microphone. I truly appreciate your ongoing support for this program. Please tell all your friends. And that's the Stuff File program mailbag. I'm Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Stick around. There's more Stuff File coming your way in a moment.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In 1776, Thomas Jefferson said judges should be a mere machine. What did he mean? Well, a properly working machine runs as directed, so he meant that judges should follow the directions of legislators who made the law, as long as it's constitutional. A lot of political experts today like to measure judges by whether they're conservative or liberal, but the first job of judges is to enforce the law, even when they don't agree with it. A few years ago, a judge on the Wisconsin Supreme Court explained Jefferson's philosophy this way. She said that if a state's highest court is working as it should, it will issue conservative rulings when conservatives control the legislature and liberal rulings when liberals control it. Let's be fair. When judges set aside politics and enforce the law, they create confidence in the law. One reason that's so important is that it gives job providers the confidence they need to grow and expand. And that's something America needs now more than ever. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart Nauman is here with us once again, and it's all about a mystery, isn't it? Yes. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. You know, I do like a mystery. There's some people who love a mystery, but I do like like the odd mystery once in a while. And on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at James Patterson, who loves mysteries. And he's produced a lot of mysteries. In fact, he's produced mysteries that sold millions and millions of copies. In fact, James Patterson is a writing machine. But he has some help. I mean, he does have people helping him out. But, he's a writing machine. And every year, he releases a slew of books that are usually his best-selling crime thrillers. Now, this past summer, Little Brown, which is Patterson's longtime publisher, they released a new way to enjoy James Patterson's prolific releases. And that they're called book shots. That's right, book shots. And they're advertised as, and I quote, stories at the speed of life. And these book shots are a series of compact, affordably priced paperbacks which are released on a regular basis, featuring Patterson's best-known series of books, like the Alex Cross novels, Zoo, The Woman's Murder Club, the Michael Bennett mysteries, that you could basically read in one sitting or two, or even less than that. The question is, can a condensed, shorter version of an original James Patterson novel be as captivating and entertaining as his full-length books? And after reading the first book in the Bookshot series, Crosskill, the answer is a very resounding yes. Now,
doesn't it also ask the question if he can condense them, then wouldn't somebody say that maybe his books are too long? I mean, there's two sides of the coin here, you know.
Yeah, that's true. But you know what, you can never say that a James Patterson book is too long or too long-winded. No. He sticks with that winning formula that sold millions of copies.
I can tell you one book of his that's too long, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
There's a tease for you.
Okay. So in this book, Crosskill, which is the first of the Bookshot series, basically Alex Cross and his partner John Sampson are volunteering at a school breakfast program in Washington, D.C., where all the stories take place, and some other ambushed by a lone gunman. Now, Cross survives the hail of bullets, but Samson, his partner, suffers a serious bullet wound to his head, and it's quite life-threatening, actually. Now, the eerie thing is that the gunman who did that attack looks like serial killer Gary Sonnegy. Now, if you're a big James Patterson fan, Gary Sonnegy was in one of Cross's first books called Along Came a Spider, and this is a serial killer whom Cross personally saw get incinerated at the end of that story. Now, does that mean Gary Sonnegy did not meet that fiery end and is back to get Alex Cross for what he did to him? Well, read and find out, folks, because, you know, this is a very interesting way that what Little Brown did. It sort of reminded me what happened in 1996 when Signet Books released six monthly installments of Stephen King's book The Green Mile, which was terrific. The books were bestsellers, and it sort of reminded of how the way Charles Dickens' books were originally released, you know, about over 150 years ago. And like I said, they were huge bestsellers, and now those original Green Mile installments are collector's items.
But, interesting, you know, that you should bring up Stephen King. But I digress. That'll come up later.
You guess you'll mention that shortly?
We'll get to that shortly.
Okay. But this this is a new way to enjoy Patterson's writing, actually. And it succeeds. It's just as thrilling and suspenseful as, for a book that's a fraction of the size of one of his regular books. And the couple of twists at the end of Crosskill sort of leaves the reader waiting in anticipation for the next Alex Cross Bookshot installment to come by. And it's an interesting experiment, and it works very well. It's very entertaining, and it's great for those who are doing public transit commutes or having to wait at an airport. Always good to have, and affordably priced too.
And the book is
called Crosskill by James Patterson, part of his Bookshot series. It's published by Little Brown, and it's only $5.99.
So he's a very prolific writer who writes and writes and writes, and he always has a book coming out. But there's a book that is not coming out. It was slated to come out in November, but it will not. Because James Patterson has canceled publication of his novel because apparently he didn't want to upset Stephen King and his family.
Oh, really?
The novel is called, because it's still out there, yeah. Although I'm assuming he's going to either put the manuscript through a shredder or perhaps, I don't know,
get the barbecue treatment like in Misery.
Yes. Well, it's funny you should bring up Misery, but I digress. The title of the book is The Murder of Stephen King.
No.
Yes. And as you know, King has dreamed up his fair share of deranged fans from Misery's axe-wielding Annie Wilkes, which you just referred to. And there's a whole bunch of villains that he's written about. And Patterson's novel, which was only announced a couple of weeks ago for publication in November, promised to feature all of Stephen King's greatest villains rolled into one. And that villain would kill Stephen King.
Obviously, Stephen King felt very uncomfortable about this.
Well, I haven't heard anything about how Stephen King felt about it, but his fans certainly went on social media drumming up a storm against Patterson over this. And by the way, back in 2009, Stephen King once described Patterson as, quote, a terrible writer. So I guess there's no love lost between these two.
No, well, and they're, you know, if they're going to, you know, how can I say, trade thrusts and parries, let's say Patterson from the comfort of his Miami beach home and King from the comfort of his mansion in Maine.
If either one of them disappears, the other better have an alibi. That's all I'm saying. Okay, so what else do you recommend in the vein of Patterson? Don't say Stephen King.
No. Although Misery is a terrific book. But if you want to read some early Patterson, read Roses Are Red. That's my favorite Alex Cross novel. That really is a terrific, suspenseful novel that you can't put down. That could have been a book shot, but it wasn't. So Roses Are Red. And also he's got, right now, a couple of new books coming out that have just been released. One is called Woman of God, by one of his other which he wrote with one of his other co-authors, Maxine Pietro. It's about the election of the first woman pope, and also his first foray into true crime writing. It's called Filthy Rich, and that's coming out. That's if the well, Woman of God has already been released, and Filthy Rich will be released very, very shortly. So those are some of the things all Patterson all the time.
But not The Murder of Stephen King.
No, that'd be funny if somehow someone gets their hands on a copy and publishes it privately. That would be almost like, you know, cult status kind of book.
Absolutely. Anyway, again, this week's book was?
It's called Cross Kill by James Patterson. It's published by Little Brown, and it's $5.99 as part of the James Patterson Bookshot series.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, not cowering behind my mansion in Miami, unfortunately. But every week in the Montreal Times, in print every Saturday, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about at a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Bay County, Michigan sheriff's deputy responded to a Family Dollar store where the manager alleged that 32-year-old Jackie Barnard had shoplifted. The deputy arrested Barnard and put her in the back of his car. When he returned, Barnard was smoking a cigarette she had apparently had hidden along with a lighter. At the jail, the deputy searched her cigarette pack and found a pill, which he showed Barnard. She leaned in for a closer look and attempted to eat it out of my hand, the deputy wrote. Her mouth was wide open and she lunged forward with it. Another search revealed more pills, 10 in a body cavity. She passed out, possibly from the pills, and was taken to hospital where she allegedly tried to steal medical supplies. According to court records, once she was back in jail, Barnard called the Family Dollar store multiple times, first to offer to pay back $5 a month if the charges were dropped, and then threatening to sue because her bicycle was now missing. Well, did they check her other body cavities? Now, I've never been to jail, but how do you end up calling the Family Dollar store multiple times? Don't you only get one phone call? Anyway, it's that time, boys and girls. We've reached the end of the program. You know what that means. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police say a bandit with a taste for espresso and fancy cookies has been nabbed because he asked an officer for directions to a Connecticut pastry shop. Stamford Police Lieutenant Thomas Barcello said that Donald Newman Smith's face was covered with a bandana when he robbed a convenience store, getting away with around $800. Police say an investigator was responding to the convenience store later when Newman Smith asked him how to get to the pastry shop. They say the investigator later recognized him as he watched surveillance footage of the robbery. Officers went to the shop and found Newman Smith sitting at an outside table drinking an espresso with a dozen pinoli cookies. Now why? Oh, why? Would you ask a cop for directions after committing a crime, thereby letting him know where he could find you after your heist? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0375. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0375. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air online as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.